Hi there, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of this city in regular weekly chapters, following the chronological tale of this place. We are at the start of a confusing sequence of events that will eventually be called the Wars of the Roses. That's wars, plural, as it was actually lots of separate conflicts that all kind of get rolled into one. We have got an awful lot to cover this chapter, so without the usual cold open, I'm just going to get straight into the action. So welcome then to chapter 162 of The Story of London. Five Dogs' Heads on Fleet Street. When telling a story, one can miss out details, and it's these details that sometimes I cherish. Like during the events of the last chapter, when Henry VI was facing down the Duke of York, there were small details that really stuck in my head. Henry VI was, in the years before the events of this chapter, trying to reinforce law and order in the country and deal with popular insurrections taking place everywhere, it seemed. While not as high profile as the rebellion of Jack Cade, these were serious. And as a result, something called the Harvest of Heads took place. Over a dozen heads of over a dozen captured rebels were boiled in tar and then stuck on spikes above the south gate of London Bridge, the newly rebuilt and repaired drawbridge section where Jack Cade and his men had burned rather than see fall to the native Londoners. To these heads were added a second wave of rebellious heads a few months later. This small detail sticks in my head. The idea that as you approached London Bridge, that bridge across the Thames, and gazed up, dozens of heads sat on spikes, rotting in the autumn skies above you. If anything, is indicative that things in the rest of the country were somewhat unstable, these did. These heads. The sheer bloody harvest. So where are we? The year is 1454. The place, London. Beyond its walls, England is gripped with a crisis. A crisis that no one can quite get their heads around. It's a crisis so big that while everyone is aware of a war with France going on, no one's talking about it. The conflict that is called the Hundred Years' War is generally assumed to have ended about now, but here's the thing, it didn't end about now, it didn't end. There was no formal sit-down, sign a peace treaty, so this is it, we're finished, meeting. Right now, the King of France was keeping large numbers of troops stationed in Gascony and Normandy, expecting the English to just sail over and start kicking down doors again. But also right now, the English state was dealing with a bunch of, well, strong personalities and dysfunctional peoples. For some of the people living in London at the time, you could do what history has done and talk about a handful of people being solely to blame. Like the king. Henry VI had shown himself to be not a very good king. Born the son of a father he never knew and whose legend hung over him his entire life, he was, at best, a weak man, someone with no skill at leadership, someone who had depended upon others to lead for him his entire life. Which meant that a stream of these characters, Cardinal Beaufort, the Duke of Suffolk, the Duke of Somerset, had all become the crutches upon which the state was run. And they weren't that good. And because of this, the state had begun to erode and break. And finally, just when everything seems to have become too much for him, the king fell into a miasma, a catatonia that nothing could get him out of. And boy, did they try to snap him out of that catatonic state. Royal physicians attempted to elicit a response from him using a variety of pretty awful sounding solutions. They forced drafts of medicines and elixirs down his throat. They manipulated his jaw to chew and swallow pharmaceutical confections. They applied pungent and strong ointments to his skin. They forced him to drink powerful laxatives and witness the resulting explosions. They cut his scalp, administering head purges of bad humours around the brain. They could pour foul-tasting liquids intended to be gargled into his mouth, which weren't gargled. They plunged him into ice-cold baths and extremely hot ones. They applied poultices, and as always, they bled him elsewhere, trying to rectify a supposed humoral imbalance. Nothing worked. Nothing. The king was catatonic. And the government, the nation, was being run now by a Lord Protector, Richard Plantagenet, the Duke of York. He was a man who had an ego the size of his ambition. He had for years sought to make himself a crucial figure in the state. He may have had the skills, potentially, but he certainly could not read a room, or a city, or a country. And this lack of judgment haunted him, leading to miscalculations and mistakes. He was sure others would see the world the same way he did. And while some did indeed, most did not. And while he was protector of the realm, in the Tower of London sat Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, the king's preferred minister, and a man who seemed to have no great ability in anything, except he was more effective than the king and less offensive than Richard, Duke of York. And between them, these three men had brought us to this moment. York was running the state, Somerset rotted in the tower, the king was a catatonic mess, and his wife, the queen, was resentful. And the nation, well, here's the thing. Around these men, the nobility of England were driving all this dysfunction. Private feuds and vendettas had metastasized into mini civil wars that were rocking England. The fabric of the state was unraveling, which in turn was causing people to rebel, which in turn was making the state unravel. This was not actually a new thing. London had witnessed this before, long ago, during the reign of Æthelred Unred. Back then, the incompetent king was actually nothing more than a symptom of a greater malaise within the nobility, as we covered all the way back between chapters 22 and 34 of The Story of London. When the system of government itself began to fall, weak kings became both symptoms of the disorder and reinforcers of the condition. Back when Æthelred had held the throne, it had taken foreign invasion to change the narrative. And now, 400 years after that Saxon king, now the state was effectively about to invade itself. And London was about to be part and parcel of everything that's to come. London, at this point, had not been entirely all up in supporting the Duke of York. It was leaning that way, but the city was still remarkably partisan for both sides. And even in the leaning Yorkist grocer's company, there was not universal support for the man. I mean, sure, there were big signs that many in the grocers did support the Duke of York. Signs? Well, if you remember last chapter, I mentioned how a bill was introduced to Parliament to make the Duke of York the heir to the king. And the guy who introduced the bill was a lawyer called Thomas Young, whose brothers and half-brothers were rising members in the Grocers' Company. So, transpires that during the Protectorate, Thomas Young was formerly made an honorary member of the Grocers Company. That's a bit of a big sign about where the mainstay of your members align, you know? But the grocers, as I said, were not united. We have the likes of the grocer Richard Hackday and another called Thomas Brown, who were very much aligned to Somerset and the King. And they brought into the livery company someone called Walter Walker. Walker was a grocer who joined the company to, quote, export wool and tin to the continent, unquote. That's a euphemism for, well, basically exporting to Antwerp or anywhere outside of the Calais staple. Walker had friends and patrons outside of the company and was working in opposition to the Yorkist mainstay. There were other men in the grocers who were closely connected with the King's household. John Petit and Thomas Clerk were indebted to two of its members, and Henry Treversham was in a trading partnership with a yeoman from the King's household. In other words, there was diversity and confusion and a plethora of opinions within the grocers of London, and they are a microcosm of the rest of the city. The situation in England, as we start, was relatively simple. The Duke of York was protector of the land right up until Christmas Day on 1454. And then, just as quickly as Henry VI had entered his stupor, he simply snapped out of it. He blinked and seemed to wake up. Within 48 hours, he sent gifts to Canterbury Cathedral to give thanks for his delivery. 5 days after he woke up, his wife, Queen Margaret, took his 14-month-old son to meet his father properly for the first time. The story goes that Henry turned to her and asked what the child's name was. When she told him the name was Edward, the name of great kings and noble English saints, the monarch thanked God. Henry VI seemed to have no memory of what happened during his stupor. He was just delighted to be back, and his ministers, when they heard he was restored, well, they, quote, wept for joy, unquote. Everyone was delighted, except, obviously, the Duke of York. For good or for bad, he had pursued a policy to make himself the head of the government for the king, and the king had preferred the Duke of Somerset. And the king's return meant that Somerset, that damn Edmund de Beaufort, was going to be released. Understand, Richard was still the Lord Protector, but the king was back, dude. By January 26th, the Duke of Somerset was indeed released from the Tower of London, and 2 weeks later, on the 9th of February, the title of Lord Protector was retired, and York lost his position and all his power. He was done. His allegations against the Duke of Somerset were thrown out, and by the 4th of March, not only were all the charges of treason against Somerset formally dropped, Somerset was appointed the captain of the Calais garrison, and the faction of wool merchants who paid and bankrolled the Calais garrison, the Staplers faction back in London, probably raised quite a few eyebrows at this appointment. These Londoners saw Richard, Earl of Salisbury, forced to resign the position of Chancellor. And within a few weeks, Salisbury's son, the Earl of Warwick, was instructed to release Henry Holland, the rather bloodthirsty Duke of Exeter, who had been imprisoned for, well, you know, being somewhat psychotic. London watched as the King and his lords bound the Duke of York to keep the peace until June, facing a forfeit fine of 20,000 marks if he broke it. And they watched as the old allies and adherents of the king now flocked to Westminster and the region around London, while the Duke of York and his allies from the north, the Nevilles, slinked away, abandoning the court and the city. And to all, the truth was clear. While Richard, Duke of York, had legitimately been given the title of Lord Protector of England, legally and with the consent of the nation, he was being treated here and now like he was some rebel, isolated from any position in the government. Yes, you could say, given his desperate ambition in the past, what the hell did he expect? We could also say that as much as the Duke of York hated the Duke of Somerset was equally petty and had it all in for the Plantagenet. In truth, everyone kind of knew right now there was probably going to be a fight. Now, before we go any further, We need to keep track of the changing circumstances in England during the conflicts to come. And as such, every so often I will be introducing brief breaks to summarise the situation with a War of the Roses scorecard. So, let us begin our first. War of the Roses scorecard, March 1455 edition. Number of wars, 0. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 0. Current regime, Henry VI is in charge and the Duke of Somerset is running the state for him. So the Duke of York went north alongside the Nevilles, father and son, the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick, and he realised he needed an army. Luckily for him, the Nevilles could supply him with one. Their conflict with the Percy dynasty meant that their men were mostly armed all the time, and they controlled, alongside the Duke of York, much of the north. So York mobilised the north. News of this soon came to London. The size of the forces, their dispositions, that was unknown. But one can imagine the debates here on London streets. York's rebelling against the king. No, said his supporters. He's seeking just to free the king from the Duke of Somerset. But the king wants Somerset. It's a rebellion. York just wants to be king himself. All eyes fell upon the Duke of Somerset in Westminster. What would he advise the king to do? No one had any idea, least of all the Duke of Somerset. Any natural commander would know what to do. You reinforce London, you allow York to come to you, and then do what they did a few years before in Dartford, as we covered last chapter. But Duke of Somerset was no natural commander. He prevaricated. London, while certainly not gone over to the Yorkist side, was filled with Yorkist advocates. The Duke's crest was, as we mentioned last chapter, found displayed above diverse houses. The true loyalty of London could be questioned, despite protestations from his supporters in the city. As such, Somerset made a bold decision and advised the king to follow a very interesting course of action. A grand council, not a parliament, but bloody close to it, was to be summoned to meet. Somerset didn't want a parliament. The Duke of York could, like the last one, dominate it. So this grand council, he was determined, would be made up of his supporters. But they couldn't hold it in Westminster, not with the fearful London mob and armed liverymen so close. So it was decided that it should be held deep within the king's land. In Leicester. Clearly Somerset had something in mind, like the settlement they imposed upon Richard back in St. Paul's. A ritual humiliation, eh? Thanks for being a protector, old chap. Now bow the knee like a good little boy. They sent out invitations to the Duke of York and his followers. Please note, it has only been less than 8 years since a similar invitation had led to the death of Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. To say the Duke of York had no incentive to turn up in Leicester was a bit of an understatement. York was not going to walk into that bear trap. But Henry VI and his followers did not know that. With his preparations done, London witnessed that by midday, Henry VI and his supporters were ready to leave Westminster, and requests were sent out to the lords and townsmen along the route north, demanding they send armed men to meet the king as quickly as possible. They were ordered to assemble in St. Albans in Hertfordshire, which lay conveniently along the road between London and Leicester. The king could pick them up and have them to supplement his own forces when he arrived there. The plans now drawn up, London watched cautiously as the king and his large entourage marched out of Westminster on Tuesday, the 20th of May, 1445. While we do not know the full numbers as they left, we figure they numbered round about 2,000 men, a formidable-looking force. The residents of Cheapside and Cornhill were no doubt busy with life and trade and buying and selling, and they probably missed the king's exit, but the residents of Westminster and Fleet Street and the environs of London, they would have seen and heard the king march north. These residents would have seen a diverse group of people around the king. There was his newly legitimised and ever so faithful half-brother, Jasper Tudor, the Earl of Pembroke. With them was the mercurial patriarch of the great dynasty of the Percys, Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland. And close by rode the much more independent-minded Humphrey, Duke of Buckingham. Amidst the great and the good came a former close ally of the Duke of York, Thomas Courtney, the Earl of Devon, and showing that nothing was quite black and white, the Earl of Salisbury's brother, William Neville, the Lord Falkenberg, rode out against him. To this was added the likes of the Earls of Wiltshire, and Lord Ross, and Lord Dudley, and Lord Clifford. The Queen was not present, they noticed, and only one bishop marched with the King. But those Londoners who paid attention soon after saw other bishops did follow later in a second group, some distance behind the first. Thus London watched the King and his party march out, not knowing that when they next saw Henry VI of England the following weekend, the whole world would have been turned upside down. The party marched north. They made good time, and by evening they took up lodgings in Watford, 7 miles south of St. Albans. Come the following dawn, the royal party rose to continue their journey. Their plan was to make St. Albans that morning, settle in and enjoy a midday meal in the town's grand abbey. But as they took the road north, the royal party was surprised to meet one of the messengers they'd only just sent out to locate the Duke of York. He had returned remarkably quickly, and the reason for his speed was soon revealed. He'd found the Duke, only a few miles north of the King in the town of Ware, with about 3,000 men. A brief moment of panic followed. The King was not in charge. He may have recovered, but by all accounts it is clear that his involvement in all that follows was mostly symbolic. All these men are acting in his name. Be a good chap, Your Majesty, and just stand up, stand over there. Thank you, Your Majesty. We'll just have a bit of a chat. Whatever the case, the chances of there being a fight, maybe even a battle, suddenly became very real. The party with the King started working on some concessions. And that morning, the 22nd of May, the Duke of Somerset was relieved of his post as Constable of England. This meant he was no longer in command of the King's armed forces. The assembled group of nobles then picked Humphrey, Duke of Buckingham, to take the post. He was the highest-ranked duke in the party, and most importantly, he wasn't an avowed enemy of the Duke of York and the Nevilles. Humphrey seemed to believe, with him in the driving seat, they could talk their way back from battle. And so, at about 7 a.m, the residents of St. Albans, a town without walls or defensive measures, just a fine-looking abbey, looked out to see a force led by the Duke of York marched into sight and took up position just east of the town, placing their tents in Key Field, within sight of the abbey and the streets around it. And at 9 a.m, the King and his forces appeared in the south and marched straight into the town centre. At this point, the residents of St. Albans kind of realised, oh shit, this is going to be serious. They hastily began erecting barricades around the town's main streets, and these townsfolks were reinforced by knights loyal to the King. Meanwhile, messengers were sent off and communications went back and forth between the two sides. Talks began. The Duke of York on one side, Dukes of Buckingham and Somerset on the other. What did York want? What he always wanted. Somerset. He wanted the Duke of Somerset and he was prepared to use violence to get that man. Buckingham could only play for time, ask for continued talk, suggest maybe some of the troops could move to a nearby town and yeah, then we could continue chatting. And while this was going on, a bunch of lads who worked for the Earl of Warwick kind of got bored, went, ah, oh, sod it, and attacked some guys at the barricades who they felt was giving them the side eye. Fighting started. The King's banner was raised over the royal forces. And the Wars of the Roses began right here and right now. Defence of the hastily erected barricades was under the command of Thomas Lord Clifford, an experienced veteran of fighting wars, mostly against the Scots. And this fighting on the barricades lasted for about an hour or so. By 11, however, York used his superior numbers and sent the Earl of Warwick on a flank attack along Holywell Street, a road which led directly to St. Peter's Square, where the royal party seemed to have based themselves. Warwick's men smashed into the barriers, and they also started smashing through the walls of houses, and finally found a weak spot, a gap between two inns, one called the Key and one called the Chequer. they burst through. More men began to go through the breach, and they were shouting aloud, "Warwick! Warwick! Warwick!" at the top of their lungs. And the Dukes of Buckingham and Somerset were clearly not ready. Many of the nobles around the king were certainly not in full armour. It appears Buckingham had not even considered that the barricades would fall so quickly or so dramatically. As Warwick's men raced towards them, total confusion broke out. The town bell began ringing in alarm to alert the rest of the forces. As Warwick's men got stuck in, fighting spread out along the cobble streets. As many defenders broke away to don their full armour before someone tried to smash their bloody heads in. The king's forces were quickly overwhelmed, and the Yorkist commander, Sir Richard Ogle, led several hundred men who smashed into the marketplace to supplement Warwick's forces. And within 30 minutes of the barricades falling, the fighting was effectively done. Right in the middle of this, looking completely bewildered, Henry VI. This king, this son of Henry V, had been alive for 33 years and had never actually seen a battle before. He apparently stood looking confused. Story goes, a stray arrow slashed near his neck, breaking the skin and causing him an injury. In the utter chaos of his forces being routed, someone manhandled him and pushed him into the house of a tanner to hide him. A tanner. The leather makers. Men who soften hide with urine to make it turn into leather. His hiding place would have stank of piss, a really rancid smell. Behind him, his banner fell to the street, sending out the idea that the king had fallen, and as it lay on the ground being trampled on, his defenders scattered even more. Henry only stayed in this piss-smelling hut for a short while, as York's men soon kicked down the door, captured him, and escorted him to the nearby precincts of the abbey. By midday, when the fighting finally ended, and the morning's bloody harvest was surveyed, the streets of St. Albans were filled with dead men and the injured. Blood and gore was everywhere. The butcher's bill was important. Three important lords of England had been slain. Thomas, Lord Clifford, had fallen as he defended the barricades. Henry, the Earl of Northumberland, the most senior male in the Percy dynasty, and the Neville's principal target, had been, surprise, surprise, savagely butchered. And a third, of course, was Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset. However, beyond that, the death toll was actually quite small. Hardly more than 40 men were killed in the Battle of St. Albans, and most of them were the king's household men, which tends to disprove the idea that appeared later that they were all cowards. The record of injuries and wounds, fatal or otherwise, shows a disproportionate number of wounds to the face, neck, arm and hands, suggesting, as one contemporary account made out, that the king's entourage did not fully arm themselves until the attackers were almost on top of them. The accounts do say that after the king was captured, there on St. Peter Street, the Duke of Somerset was forced to defend himself in a tavern called the Castle. He fought alongside his 19-year-old son, Henry Beaufort. Here they made their last stand. Young Henry was savagely slashed down. He'd leave St. Albans in a cart, grievously injured, near death. His father, however, had been beaten down, dragged out of the castle into the street, and there he'd been physically hacked to pieces. The Duke of Buckingham and the Earl of Wiltshire both fled into other parts of the abbey. Buckingham was badly injured, and Wiltshire, well, he'd not been able to put his armour on in time, but he had put on the robes of a monk in order to try and disguise himself. York's troops continued to cause mayhem even after the battle. Their bloodlust was up. Some of the king's men were fleeing across the countryside. York, Salisbury and Warwick respectfully entered the abbey, found the king, escorted him to the actual shrine of St. Alban, and then requested that they be now received as his faithful subjects and advisers. The king honestly had no choice. He agreed, asked that they keep him unhurt, saying he'd be ruled by them. The Duke of York sent out orders that the mayhem in St. Albans was to stop, and eventually it did. The Duke of York had won. Did he think it was over? A short, bloody conflict that left him in charge, and that would be that. Probably he did. It is probable that Richard Plantagenet saw this as the final moment of a long-running conflict, the final sentence in the row between him and Edmund, the Duke of Somerset. He had achieved by violence what politics had been unable to give him for the last 5 years, the elimination of his chief political rival, the head of the House of Beaufort, and he now had control of the King's government. On Friday the 23rd, the day after the killing in St. Albans, the King, Henry, was escorted back to London by the victors, and over the following weekend, London was greeted with, well, incredible propaganda. It began with a royal parade on the Saturday, unlike anything London had ever seen. There was the King riding through London. The streets were crowded. And, quote, "In great honour, the said Duke of York riding on his right side and the Earl of Salisbury on his left side and the Earl of Warwick bearing his sword," unquote. Yep, the new regime of the two Nevilles and the Duke of York was on full show. But that parade was only the start of the weekend's propaganda events. On the next day, a Sunday, the King was again escorted out of Westminster in full regality to the Cathedral of St. Paul's, where before a packed audience on the site of the Duke of York's humiliation only a few years before, the audience now watched as the Duke of York handed the King his crown. And now it's time for an update. War of the Roses scorecard, post-May 1455 edition. Number of wars, 1. Number of times Henry VI had been captured, 1. Current regime, Henry VI is formally under the second protectorate of the Duke of York. London took one look at this and immediately saw which way the wind was going. And within London, you quickly saw the election of Yorkist supporters to position of power, both in the city and in the Grocers' Company. John Walden became an alderman of the company, and in the autumn, John Young was appointed sheriff by the new mayor, Stephen Forster, who, despite having given loans to the King, had prudently decided to stray on a middle path. Forster was a fishmonger by origin and clearly seems to have wanted to keep London in the middle between the factions. But it was also clear to many that right now the conflict was over. York had won, Somerset had lost. The grocer's dominance was further strengthened by the choice of William Marrow as the new mayor. Marrow was a grocer, seemingly one of the New Yorkist faction, and you get the sense, the way the company started showing off their influence, that they felt they were on the up. And how did they show off their influence? Well, they spent big in that year's mayoral procession. Remember, there's a recession going on and a coin shortage, and we'd seen the grocers have to cut back over the previous years because the amount of money they had was being reduced. Their election feast had turned into an election supper and then had become election drinks as budgets were cut. But with the elevation and success of the Duke of York, now the grocers clearly decided it was time to spend big and show off to everybody they're the winning party. They hired 16 trumpeters for their procession, which cost them £5.06.08 and probably made a heck of a racket. And it appears that the numbers of men in livery were expanded for the occasion by persuading those who had previously worn only the hood to pay for their full livery. 62 men in livery and 60 men in hoods paid for the mayor's minstrels. The grocers were all up in their victorious drip. The Duke of York could be also under no illusions witnessing this. He could be fairly sure that the powerful Grocers' Company of London was fully supporting him, or at least powerful members of that body, and that they had secured London's government for him, and as such, they would expect reward and preferential treatment. Soon after Mayor Marrow's elevation as mayor, several senior men in the company went by boat to Westminster to visit the Duke, and soon after he returned the favour by visiting Guildhall and lent his weight to help his supporters deal with members of their own company who had been aligned with Somerset's regime. This tied into Richard Hakerty, who had refused to pay his dues in the company for about 8 years and There was other taxes he'd earned from the king, which he was meant to share out to the company, which he didn't do. He'd resisted the pro-Yorkist faction in the livery company because he had the backing of the royalists at court who protected him. But now York was in power and, well, Haggerty was summoned to Grocers' Hall and he was forced to agree to a settlement, which included paying the company a share of the tax profits he'd been granted by Henry VI and 100 marks of his own debt. In the same way, the Duke of York's ascendancy promised better news for the Stapler faction. The year before, the garrison in Calais had seized all the wool in the town, which was worth over £26,000, and sold it in order to recover unpaid wages. The wool merchants of London could only hope to recover this money they'd lost from the royal government. And once again, they were now negotiating with the Duke of York, and he needed them to spend even more of their money to persuade the massive garrison in Calais to accept as their captain his ally, the Earl of Warwick. This allowed the Staplers to complain again about the licenses given to evade the staple. They petitioned the Duke in July 1455 that the Italians should be prevented from travelling around the country and buying up wool, cloth and tin. They asked that the Italians should be restricted to buying their goods only in London, Westminster, Southampton and Sandwich. Although York did not commit himself to this radical proposal, he had no choice but to ally with the Staplers so that the garrison could be paid and the Earl of Warwick admitted to their command. In view of the king's repeated failure to keep his promises, it seemed that the Staplers felt they had no choice but to commit themselves to the Yorkist nobles. Only from the Duke, who had once again assumed the position of protector, were they likely to recover the £39,000 which was now owed to them, and which the Duke of York now pledged should be repaid to the Staplers through customs. Meanwhile, as York worked to establish for the second time his authority as chief counsellor of the king and the effective governor of England, the ambassador for Milan wrote back to his home state, quote, "Peace reigns. The Duke of York has the government and people are very pleased at this," unquote. Even if that was true, the situation wasn't going to last for long. York's policy following his victory at St. Albans had been to establish a second protectorate, identical to what had existed during the king's illness. He secured reappointment as protector on the 15th of November, 1455, and for 4 months did his best to exercise royal authority in the cause of unity and good government. But whereas during the first protectorate, the king had, you know, kind of been like a vegetable, during the second protectorate, the king's a weight mate, and he's over there. York was also obliged to reward his allies in the Neville family and in other families for getting rid of Somerset. The Earl of Warwick, as we said, was awarded captaincy of Calais and got some lands in Wales where Somerset had land and titles. Other families had been rewarded, but they were few. And it gave the impression that the second protectorate was a small clique rather than this national enterprise of unity that York genuinely thought he could make. Politics had become far more strained and fractious in the aftermath of the violence that he'd provoked. And although he did enjoy some successes, it did look like he stamped out the worst successes of the Courtenay-Bonville conflict going on in the West Country. It was not enough to convince people that a Yorkist government was going to work. And the Duke of York ran into serious difficulty in early 1456 when Parliament demanded an act of resumption. What they wanted was lands that had been given away by the crown in the years previously should now be swept back into royal possession in order that those lands could generate money for the king and he wouldn't have to beg of Parliament as much. Since York had a mandate to try and, you know, bring some order and stability to the government, he supported the policy and did his best to convince the lords to go along with it. The problem was he didn't have anywhere near enough support to encourage men who'd been personally enriched by these grants to suddenly give them up with no compensation. The act was rejected by a large number of England's lords, and the Duke of York felt he had no choice but to resign the protectorship on the 25th of February, 1456. He tried to remain involved in the government throughout the spring and the summer. He organised military defences when the Scots raided. But his authority was visibly ebbing away daily. As spring moved on, in public he began to be scorned. And in London, the greatest example of this was a horrific political protest. Someone took five dogs, severed their heads, stuck them on poles and erected the poles on Fleet Street, with each dead mouth holding a satirical poem against the Duke of York, quote, that man that all men hate, unquote. By the autumn, it was clear that his rule was over. His allies and supporters were being dismissed from their offices, and they were being replaced by men loyal to Queen Margaret. Wars of the Roses scorecard, mid-1456 edition. Numbers of wars, 1. Numbers of times Henry VI had been captured, 1. Current regime, Henry VI back in charge, but the person driving it all is his Queen Margaret. Back in London, it was now clear that the staplers and the grocers had another dramatic change in fortune to contend with. I'm not surprised they're not suffering from whiplash right now. They had not reckoned with the personality and energies of Queen Margaret, fighting not so much for the power of her rather useless husband, but for the rights of her infant son. As York's influence over the court and the lords had dwindled after he resigned, the staplers with their allies in London had once again began to have to contemplate a future in which the repayment of the huge sums of money owed to them was now somewhat uncertain, and the factions taking over the court were far more inclined to support the Italians. The grocers thought it prudent to show the new side that they could pivot towards them, and chose as their new alderman in August 1456 the non-Yorkist Stephen Brown. And this whiplash was going to have a side effect. And we saw it in April and May of 1456, because London suddenly erupted into violence. That spring, the city was facing the same circumstances that had seen trouble kick off back in the 1370s. There was failure in war, there was ineffectual and corrupt government, there was recession and unemployment, and after York's resignation, there was a real prospect of fresh royal support for foreigners at the expense of London's business interests. And once again, it was the servants and the apprentices of the mercers who were the most prominent in the outbreak of violence towards Italians. With their cloth exports now severely depressed, the mercers really were worried about the Italians, who were increasingly shipping wool to Antwerp, but then on their return trade were bringing back linen and other small mercery wares, which were the mainstay of the mercers' imports from Antwerp. Given the virtual monopoly the Italians already enjoyed over velvets and damasks, the greater involvement in the Antwerp trade could only result in more unemployment for the men of the mercery. These mercers were blinded by the vast quantities of silk and luxuries they saw in the warehouses of men like Alessandro Palestrelli, who originally came from Lucca in Italy. The richer mercers would have been more than happy to take over control of silk imports, and while the staplers amongst them, led by William Cantillo, were nearly at breaking point in 1456 over an excessive number of licenses just granted to Italians to export English wool direct to Italy. And this meant that in the April of 1456, servants of the mercers, quote, were about to do evil, unquote, as the clerk of the city's government phrased it. John Edwards, William Rightwise and John Box, servants, assaulted the Lucanese merchant Alessandro Palestrelli in Cheapside. They broke a dagger over his head. It started off a major kickoff, and this took the authorities by surprise. The grocer mayor, William Marrow, imprisoned the chief culprit. Then, as he left Guildhall with two sheriffs, one of whom was John Young, they found themselves ambushed and virtually made prisoner by a large crowd of mercers' apprentices who forced them to release Edwards, who'd been the ringleader. And afterwards, there seemed to have been an attack on the sheriffs, led by a servant called Alexander. And on the evening of the next day, London saw a well-organised ransack of the houses of the Italians in London. Young mercers operating in mobs, kicking down doors, bludgeoning anybody who got in the way, grabbing expensive items and materials and running off into the streets laden with booty. Now, these mobs were finally broken up by the sheriffs, and captured rioters were dispatched to Newgate, and the ringleader, John Edwards, fled to Westminster Abbey to claim sanctuary. But the seething threat of more violence from the young mercers sat over the city, and it was so great that the actual first session of the trials actually came to a hasty end on May 1st. The mayor and the aldermen realised that they would have to find ways to discipline the companies that didn't involve the courts. The master mercer, William Cantelow, and the wardens of the mercers took oaths that they would now keep the peace. And the sheriffs and mayor sent out patrols of between 1 to 200 men dressed in the red and white livery of the city, there to keep order. When things calmed down, trials were held, but no mercers were found amongst the 2 or 3 men hung. Of course, while they made a deal with the mercers, everybody understood how these things worked. The mercers' company diplomatically paid for wine to be given to the interrogators of their young offenders, and leading members of the mercers' company, Hugh Wishy, Geoffrey Boleyn, Ralph Verney and John Locke, they agreed they had to answer for the conduct of their servants, and considerable sums of money were extracted. Besides the men I've already mentioned, other ringleaders are named as apprentices called Thomas Thurston and Thomas Grunty, and servants of the mercers Ralph March, William Redknapp, John Catford and John Goldwell, and some very lively servants of a haberdasher called John Sinkeely. In the aftermath, then, a committee of aldermen and commoners met with those Italians who remained in London after the mayhem, and they came to an agreement over compensation. By the end of May 1456, as the city calmed down after the riots, everyone took stock. There was a lot to be getting on with. The young mercers had just gone insane across the city. The protectorate of York had fallen, and the king was in shock. For the moment, in the city, all was quiet. But now free of the Duke of York, the Royal Council of Henry VI also wished to make its authority be felt. And although there had been hangings to do with those riots, revolt still simmered beneath the surface, and the court felt it was being exploited by the Yorkists to increase their following. It became clear to the Queen and her advisers that it was not safe for the court to remain near London. Eventually, she would decide to relocate to Coventry. But before they left, the royal court wished to express its displeasure at the mercers. William Cantelow, who had been the master of the mercers and a stapler during the Troubles, was summoned and imprisoned in Dudley Castle that October. In early November, the city wrote letters asking for his release, but he was not back at the court of aldermen until the 16th of December, and him and John Sinkeely, the haberdasher, and almost certainly all of the mercer masters involved, were bound over to keep the peace and charged considerable sums of money. This was ill-advised and caused resentment. And later, these resentful mercers would be happy to, say, throw their support behind a resurgent Yorkist faction. But that lay in the future. And so for now, we're going to bring this episode to a close. there's a lot more to come. The five heads on Fleet Street condemning the Duke of York represented a city that was fever pitch. The kickoff by the Mercers, which wasn't over yet, was part and parcel of something greater. London was taking a deep breath. It and the rest of the country was about to plunge into far more dangerous waters. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week for another episode of The Story of London. This is Saul, hoping you're all okay.